Tango Tango Papa, 1880, November 4th, 2014.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Colton, California. So, where did I unload at? After I unloaded, you know, I came back to work, and then I ended up going to McDonough, Georgia. And then after that, they ended up having me pick a load up in, what was it, Blountsville, Alabama. And then that load delivers to Colton, California. So today is the 4th. It's actually, I got here about 4:30 this afternoon. And now I guess it's about, Pacific time, it's about 5:30 now. So I've been here roughly about an hour. And it's, sun's down now and it's kind of dark. When I got here, the sun was in the process of going down. Of course, we had the time change, and you know that kind of makes it get dark by around 5, kind of depending on where you're at in the time zone too. So anyway, I got here, and the load that I have delivers tomorrow morning, the 5th, at 8:30 a.m. So I'll go in there at they'll let me in at 7:30 a.m. Pacific time. So, I'm here, and there's actually, I've picked loads up at this place several times. This is the first time I'll be delivering a load to this. It's a big warehouse. This is the first time I'll be delivering a load here, but they've got, there's a big long street near the place that kind of leads to the place, and, there's all kind of, you know, they let trucks park along the side of this road. It's sort of an industrial park type of area. This is kind of really typical of California. And so, you know, there's parking, there's a place to park. And so it's kind of ironic. I was thinking about parking here anyway, because I knew that the parking was here, and then I realized that it was actually the same warehouse. So I was planning on probably, you know, because I knew I was going to get here early or, you know, kind of in the afternoon. So I was planning on parking at this place anyway, even if, you know, because I knew it couldn't be very far away to wherever the warehouse was that I'm going to. But as it turns out, it's, you know, it's just I'm looking at it through my windshield off in the distance. So, course, let's see, so today's November the 4th, so today's election day, and of course my email has just been going kind of nuts with you know, things begging for money and so on and so forth, and you know, of course I've ignored all of them. Whenever I receive phone calls, if I don't recognize the number, I don't answer it, and of course they don't ever leave voicemails. So they're looking for money. The Republican Party, you know, the people that are in charge of it at this point are traitors, and you know, never give them another dime. And you know, they're making kind of a big deal. If you look at the headlines, which I'm not paying that much attention to it, but they're saying, oh, the Republicans are going to win. It's not, I don't look for it to make a bit of difference whether who wins, if it's the Democrats win or the Republicans win. The real problem, you know, you get the Republicans in there, that's not going to change anything. The real problem is the morals. And as long as the morals are in the toilet, and I'm talking about family value type morals, I'm not talking about, you know, some kind of made up morals where we have to be nice to, you know, sort of recognize people's sins and all that type of thing. those are sort of fake morals. Those are false values. I'm talking about real values as far as a husband and a wife and the nuclear family and that type of thing. That's what has to be intact, and that's what's kind of been destroyed. You have all these people just kind of, you know, screwing around indiscriminately and getting pregnant and then killing the, you know, killing the unwanted offspring, you know, in the form of abortion and so on and so forth. And, you know, it's that kind of, you can try to dress that up and make it seem like that's, you know, we're civilized and that's how civilized societies operate and so on and so forth. You can try to make it sound like that's the modern thing to do. And it's wrong. It's sin. And that's why our society's in the toilet. People's lives are empty. You know, if you're born into a situation like that, your life is basically, you've got a bunch of strikes already against you. Now, that's not to say, you know, there are people that, you know, there are people that'll survive almost any kind of, you know, horrible, rotten childhood as far as being able to, you know, survive only having one parent and, you know, it's usually mom because usually dad, you know, don't even know who dad is or dad can't keep his, pardon the French, can't keep his dick in his pants and he's, you know, just, you know, screwing everything in sight, that type of thing. You know, and that's rampant, and it has been for years. It's not something that just happened in the past few years. This is rampant, and it's been going on for a long time. It's epidemic. It's gotten worse. You want to talk about epidemics? Well, the epidemic, we have an epidemic of immorality, and it's been going on for a long time, and now it's reached, you know, it's reached critical levels, and we're reaping the results of it. So I look for no changes to come about as a result of politics. That's the wrong place to look. And it, you know, I finally, in the past few years, I sort of tumbled to that fact. And I really don't care about politics anymore, because it's politics just arises out of the decay of real morality. Sort of politics arises out of the decay of the so-called nuclear family. And so I don't look for anything to change. I think that, you know, if anything, things are probably going to get worse. The only thing that can instigate real change from a moral standpoint is suffering. People are going to have to suffer, and there are already a bunch of people suffering, and, you know, people have to, there, you know, and there's a percentage of people, as I've said many times before, there's a percentage of people, they wake up in the gutter, they find themselves in the gutter, either literally or figuratively. Some of them will start thinking rationally and kind of get up out of the gutter because there's no place left to go. They have to start thinking rationally, and there are other people that'll just die in the gutter. And so if you die in the gutter, serves you right. You know, and if you find yourself in the gutter, time to wake up. So, anyway, I've got some audio comments from Scott, and so I'm going to start playing these. I don't know, really, we're going to be listening to them together for the first time, so I don't really know what, you know, I know Scott's going to be kind of reacting and making comments to recent podcasts, you know, my recent podcasts. So, you know, and I don't know, I've got four comments right now, and I don't know if I'll get through all of them or not. It just kind of depends on how long I react to his reaction. So anyway, let's just jump right on into that. So here is Scott.
Well, Tom, I don't know if you're still taking comments and if you air all comments, but I guess this will tell the tale here. I do want to make a couple points. One is, when making a point about making predictions, which a lot of people love to do. But a prediction is no prediction at all if you don't give a time frame to it. It just isn't. And I'll give you some examples of that, why it's just ridiculous to listen to somebody make a prediction with no time frame whatsoever. That's no prediction at all. That's somebody blowing hot air. Nostradamus, famous for doing that. Oh, he was so great. But they've basically proven that what they are doing is they will take the things that he predicted and they will go cherry-picking through all history. Ah, here's where this happened. Here's where that happened. The Bible, the parts of the Bible that are supposedly predicting the future, same thing. And it's sort of like if I was to say that today, today we have sunshine, but mark my word, there's going to be a week of rain. I can't tell you just when, but there's going to be a week of rain. And then after that, there's going to be a heavy snowstorm. And then there'll be some really good weather. Well, if you wait long enough, all of that will come to pass. You just have to cherry pick the times when it does. It's meaningless without a date. And that's what they do with Nostradamus. That's what they do with a lot of biblically based prophecy and things like that. It can't have any meaning unless you affix a time frame to it to really show that you knew what the heck you were talking about. Otherwise, you know, it's like me saying, you know what, I'm going to tell you something. I don't know exactly when, but somebody's going to hit the lottery for $1 billion. I don't know when, but it's going to happen. And then someday, I think you pretty much know, Tom, someday somebody will. They're getting up to $500 million all the time now on these super Powerball lotteries. It's been up to $500-600 million. So, yeah, someday it'll hit $1 billion. That's no prediction at all, is it? It's like saying, you know something, I know you're going to die one of these days. I can't tell you just when. Anyway, there's so much on predictions without time limits. If you haven't got a time limit, it's really not a prediction. Because almost anything will and can't happen in time. You know, it's like a likelihood sort of thing.
Okay, so in regards to predictions, I actually agree with you. As far as, you know, somebody's predicting, you know, the typical thing, you know, where, you know, especially like the psychic, you know, like, you know, Nostradamus was, you know, I don't know if he was kind of psychic or whatever, you know, the people that, especially the, you know, because he was French and they always make a big deal out of, Nostradamus, or you watch some of these shows and I'm kind of tired of, as far as those, any kind of Nostradamus or UFOs or those kind of shows. I would watch them a long time ago, but at this point it's just all, you know, I'm tired of that kind of stuff because it does never go anywhere, of course. So I agree with you that you know, if somebody's able to say, well, I predict on such and such a date that such and such is going to happen, and it does, then you got something there. But otherwise, not so much. Now, the other type of prediction, you know, that's not really a prediction. It might seem like a prediction, but I can tell you that, for example, you know, it's kind of like a cake formula or a formula to live your life by. If you do, you know, you engage in certain things, you violate certain moral principles, then certain things are, you know, you are going to be result as a consequence. And so that type of thing, that's not really making a prediction. That's sort of like using a slide rule and saying that if you do such and such, then this will be the result, or, you know, so it's more of a, that's more of a, you know, kind of going off of a, you know, sort of, you know, almost like a slide rule, like if you do such and such, and I'm talking about from a moral standpoint, And so it's, you know, that's why our country, you know, it's predictable that, of, you know, what's happened to the USA and other, you know, plenty of other countries. But it's really predictable from a moral standpoint. Now, I can't tell you, you know, is the country going to dissolve? I have no idea. Is the economy going to get better? Who knows? It might. It may get better. It may go to hell. Who knows? But what I can tell you is that the morals have gone into the toilet, and as a result, you know, we see certain types of social decay, and the inevitable result, you know, you look at, you know, pick your country, you know, from history, pick your country, they always, every country always has a, you know, civilization always has a rise, and then it kind of hits a peak, and then it falls. And if you really look carefully, the fall is always, it's based on, you know, the morals go to hell in a handbasket. And that leads to the fall. And so, and that happens individually. It can happen to us individually, and it happens to us collectively as a group. So, you know, but that type of, you know, that's more of a formula. You know, there's certain things that, you know, like your parents, you know, your, if you got a decent parent, they tell you to avoid doing certain things, you know, from a moral standpoint. And if you do what they tell you not to, you're going to find yourself in trouble. Sooner or later, you're going to find yourself in trouble. And, you know, and then you're going to realize that they were right, that, you know, but, so that's more of a slide rule type of thing. That's not really making a prediction. It's just, you know, it's more of a, you know, and I'm really more interested in the moral side of things, as far as it relates to the so-called nuclear family, because the family unit is what everything is based on. As far as, you know, real morals go. Now, you can talk about cruelty to animals and cruelty to this and cruelty to that and bullying and, you know, all of these so-called, you know, they're sort of false morals. They're not real. You know, of course you shouldn't be cruel to animals and so on and so forth. But that's not, those aren't morals. Those aren't, you know, and you can call it family values. But if, you know, once you start violating the nuclear family and destroying it, you get to a certain point where kind of a critical mass, and it's going to wreak all kinds of havoc on your country. And sooner or later, you won't have one. And it's not a prediction. It's just a fact. You know, you engage in certain types of misbehavior, and there's a penalty for it, whether you like it or not. And it's just a kind of a natural result of kind of violating the moral laws in the universe we find ourselves in. And we, you know, and contrary to what people would like to think, we don't create our own morality. So there's plenty of people that would love to, but it doesn't work that way. You know, because if you try to create your own, reality, you know, kind of live in a false world, and sooner or later, reality is going to catch up with you whether you like it or not. So, but I agree with you that, you know, anyone trying to predict, let's say they're trying to predict the stock market's going to hit such and such by whatever date, you know, if somebody does it, then kudos to them. But, you know, you have people that are predicting the stock market is going to crash and so on and so forth. And, you know, of course it will. At some point it will. At some point it's going to hit new highs. You know, you just don't know. But And I don't even care about those kind of predictions. You know, they can make kind of, they can be sort of interesting from time to time. But my, I've, as far as me being interested in those kind of predictions and people making those kind of predictions, my interest was used up in that kind of thing some time ago. So anyway, let's get to the second part of Scott's comment here.
Okay, so the other thing was about, I sent you a whole bunch of these songs, and I am sort of catching up on podcasts. They were these morality tales, and they struck me as being kind of liberal. And I figured you'd probably rail at them, but you're really liking them. But interesting that you say things, and then you, it seems like you fold right back on what you said. And I'll give you an example. You know, say, because the general theme of all of these PSAs was that we should all just get along, live and let live. The color of the skin, your nationality, that doesn't matter. That all of these people made America great, and we should just live and let live and be good with it. And there was that one song about, you know, do I fight for what is right, but do I stand up for yours, you know? And see, that again starts to sound like, okay, do people here stand on their own rights ahead of somebody else's rights? And in the case of all nationalities being equal, all cultures being equal, being multicultural, but then you were saying, yeah, but they got to be like us. You know, they can't come here and start, they got to give up their culture when they come here. They got to forget about what they really are, and they got to be us. You know, well, I don't believe for a second that that's what this was all about. There was way too much of stressing this point for that to be the case. And in fact, it never even was the case. You know, you look at American history and some of the big populace that created this country who came here for all kinds of different reasons. Some were refugees, I believe Chinese, large amounts of them, refugees. Today they'd be considered illegal alien. There was no such thing as legal immigration back then. You just showed up. You just showed up. French. I mean, look at what happened in town after town after town. You've got Little Italy, you got Chinatown, you got all these areas. They did not give up their heritage and their culture. They rebuilt little communities that were just like back home. The German community, the Irish community, you know, Chinatown and Little Italy and everything else. That was America. So no, they did not give up their culture, and they were not expected to. Now, maybe this is some new rule that somebody wants to make up, but I don't think that that's quite the way it was. Certainly not in the times back when, and I don't think that that's what the song was thinking about. Just saying. Just saying. I don't think that that's what it was. I think it was very much, a lot of people today are very upset by multiculturalism, and I you know, it sometimes bugs me too, certain things to do with it. But in general, I think it's a good idea, and I think you do too. But the idea of saying that people have to give up their culture and they have to act just like us, is it's never been that way. That's all I wanted to say. We'll catch you later.
Okay, well, thank you, Scott. You know, now, of course, those songs were, I don't know what the date on those was now. That's been a while. I would say probably maybe 40s, 50s. If you look, you know, I know every city's got Little China and Little This and Little That. You know, or at least they had that. And, you know, some places still have that kind of thing. But if you actually, you know, look at what happened, you know, California, I'm in the state of California right now, and, you know, of course, you go to San Francisco, don't know if you've ever been there, but they have this area of San Francisco called Chinatown, and you kind of drive through there, and there's all these Chinese restaurants and so on and so forth, and they've really decorated it so that it has kind of a, what we would, at least in America, would think of as sort of a Chinese feel to it. It has a real Chinese sort of feel to it, at least what we would think it is. Now, what, you know, and of course the Chinese restaurants that we have in America are, that's not Chinese. You know, we think we know what Chinese food is. We don't have a clue. That's American. You know, those are American inventions. You know, that the General Tso's chicken or whatever, that's a completely an American invention. Fortune cookie. You know, people. You go to China and you ask those people what a fortune cookie is, and they're not going to know what that is. That was actually a kind of a Japanese invention, and it's, you know, more than anything, the fortune cookie is really in a kind of an American thing. You know, but we, you know, you go to Chinatown and you think, oh, there's all these Chinese restaurants. Yeah, right. That, but what inevitably happens to those people, you listen to their kids, you know, you listen to people talk, and you don't have to see their face, but if you can just listen to people talk, they sound American. You know, they're especially, you know, maybe their parents had the, you know, whatever accent from whatever country they came from. But then you listen to their kids, and the kids don't have the, you know, they sound American. And there's people like that all across this country. That, you know, people have different looks, but they sound American. And, you know, we can relate to them. You know, in most cases, you know, regardless of which state you're born in and you were raised in, you can meet people from other, you know, from completely across the country and so on and so forth, and you're able to relate to them. You know, there's going to be different details, and maybe their lives are a little bit different, but for the most part, it's recognizably American. And, you know, so I'm not saying, you know, you have to give your culture up and so on and so forth, your heritage and all of that, but people, you know, the idea is people do come here and they kind of become American. And, you know, I was watching, if you go onto YouTube, and I don't remember what I was searching for, but I ended up running across these videos of some expatriate-type people that, you know, had tried to move to, you know, pick some country in South America or Central America where they were going to move and, excuse me, buy the land and kind of get away from the United States because it's going to collapse and so on and so forth. And some of these people, you know, as long as there was this one guy in particular that said he really tried to, you know, he was going to try to blend in with the natives and so on and so forth. And what he found, and this guy was kind of a California hippie type guy, what he ended up finding was that he couldn't, you know, those people wouldn't accept him. You know, and, you know, he just didn't know the language that well enough where he could really carry on a conversation. And he said the only way that, in, you know, like this, some of the South American cultures would accept you would be if you, maybe if you married into their family and you really tried to learn the language, they might sort of accept you, but otherwise, no, they're not going to accept you. You know, because it's just too big of a barrier. You know, so the cultural barriers are pretty significant, and you find out what they are if you know, you go to some other country and you really find out that those people have a, you know, that just really an alien culture. And you know, and even, you know, so-called multiculturalism, you know, and the ones I see all the time are the Mexicans. You know, I see there's plenty of Mexicans. I live in Northwest Arkansas. We've got tons of Mexicans, just tons and tons of them that have, you know, part of them have, you know, I'm sure have come there illegally. A lot of them have become citizens, but what inevitably happens, they become Americanized. And, you know, and their kids, even though the kids may end up speaking Spanish, the kids also end up speaking perfectly good American English with a nice American accent thrown in. So, and that happens over and over again. So those people, you know, you move to wherever it is, especially America, and you're going to be kind of become Americanized. Now, I know there are plenty of people that hate that think that America doesn't have any culture, or they hate, you know, whatever it is that America is, or whatever they think it represents. There are people that, you know, right, that are born here that are kind of think, you know, they hate that kind of thing. You know, and those kind of people tend to live on, you know, either the East Coast or the West Coast. But, you know, there are plenty of people that move to the United States and end up becoming American. You know, they become Americanized. And that's especially true once they, if they have kids, then those kids kind of end up, you know, becoming American, and it doesn't, you know, and then it really doesn't matter what they look like. Where, you know, the big divide is with people isn't so much with what people look like, but as I've said many times before, it revolves around language. And, you know, language is a huge, huge barrier. And, you know, an example of that is French-speaking Quebec versus the rest of Canada. You know, for a long time, Quebec was talking about, oh, we're going to secede and we're going to become our own country and so on and so forth. And that fizzled. But they, you know, they were really intent on, you know, the French is such a beautiful language, and they wanted, you know, and they've still got laws that the, you know, if you're going to put up a sign, that the French letters have to be so much bigger than the English letters underneath it. And they still, as far as I know, those laws are still in effect, and it's kind of crazy. But they're trying to maintain their culture via the language. But it really, culture really is, and is, you know, it revolves around language. You know, so, you know, kind of modifying what I said, or just maybe restating it, if you come to live in America, you know, you can keep your language, and if you want to, you know, speak whatever it is at home, that's hunky-dory, that's just fine. But when you come to the country, then you should be able to speak English. You know, you have to be able to speak the language of the country that you're visiting. You know, you go try visiting going down into Mexico and or you know, pick some country in South America, or even some country, you know, go to some place in Europe or something, but especially, you know, or China. You go visit China somewhere outside of the major cities and see, you know, you better know some Chinese, or you better know some language of, you know, the language of the country that you're trying to visit, you know, because, you know, the chances are they're not going to know English, you know, and so that coming here, and especially if you go there to live, you'd better know the language, you know. So you come to America to live, you know, whether you want to or not, you're going to end up learning English anyway. You know, the kids will. Even if the parents don't, the kids do. And where I come into contact with the illegal immigrants in Northwest Arkansas typically is through restaurants. We got, as a result of the, you know, for whatever reason, Northwest Arkansas is a destination for Mexicans coming from Mexico. For whatever reason that is, we have some really excellent mom and pop type Mexican restaurants as a result. And sometimes, you know, there'll be a waiter or a waitress in a place in one of those Mexican restaurants, and they have a hard time speaking English. But after a little while, you know, you wait a few months, and the same, you know, those people, you know, they may not speak perfect English, but they've picked up enough on it where they kind of know, you know, they're able to do their, you know, to do their job. And so it's really more about language, I think, than anything else. You know, customs, you know, can clash, you know, and I think where the biggest kind of clash happens is, you know, the people from the Middle East wanting to kind of, you know, have the Sharia law and bring Sharia law into whatever country that they're in. That is a little bit, that's over the top, because, you know, the Sharia law, I don't know how much you know about it, but it's pretty alien to our values. And you know, if they're going to, if somebody's going to move into, you know, whatever country, you know, you come to America, you have to, you know, according to the way I think, you have to adopt our values, whether you like them or not. If you don't like our American values, then find some other country or stay where you're at. If you want your Sharia law or whatever, stay where you're at and have it if it's so wonderful. But you know, they try to bring that with them, and that's just too alien compared to what we have, you know. So that's a case where their quote unquote traditions or whatever are rather over the top, you know, where they have the honor killings and so on and so forth. And if you don't know what that is, just type honor killings and into Google, and you can figure it out pretty quick. So you just type Sharia law in there, and there's all everything you ever wanted to know about it. So that is a case where leave that. If you're going to come and be an American, leave that. Don't bring that with you.
Okay, another quick comment here to send in. A comment about the student that was suspended, I guess, I think it was, for what he wrote in a Facebook page. And then the girl who was given a suspension or something like that was reprimanded for saying bless you in class. First of all, I have to say that I think the two sides of the coin that are the worst are the zealots, religious zealots on one side and atheistic zealots on the other side. And I've known both. And the religious zealots get very upset that you don't believe in God, and the atheists get very upset that you do. And pretty much it seems like that story was a case of a teacher who was an atheistic zealot. So that was just abundantly clear that the problem wasn't the school system, it was the teacher. It was personnel.
Okay, let me interrupt. You know, lately I've been talking about idolatry and, you know, kind of it's the different forms that it takes. And you're calling it zealotry, you know, religious zealotry or atheistic zealotry. And it's really what we're talking about, or what you're talking about there, is idolatry. And idolatry happens everywhere. I'm seeing it really everywhere. And that's really what it is. It's idolatry. You know, it's easy if I've talked about it in terms of, kind of Apple. People sort of idolizing. There's a certain segment of the population that idolizes Apple. And that's why, you know, Apple can do no wrong in their eyes and so on and so forth. And it's because it's idolatry. And so that happens also in religion. People idolize, you know, the very thing they think that they're being saved and so on and so forth, and they've got the words about the truth and so on and so forth, and they actually take that and they turn it into idolatry. And so then they kind of push the wording and so on and so forth. But you can also have the opposite of that. And the opposite is the people that are the zealot, the atheistic zealots, because that's also, whether they want to realize it or not, that's also their form of idolatry. And what is idolatry? Idolatry is worshiping a false god. You can idolize something, and in this case, you know, there's a certain segment of people that idolize, they're idolizing atheism, and they think about it all the time, and it sort of defines them. They're constant, they can't talk about anything else. you know, so there are, that's the type of person that, that, you know, this teacher probably was, you know, where she's kind of idolizing, she's one of the ones that's sort of idolizing atheism. You know, so it is, that's, it's all idolatry, you know, or you could call it, you know, there's a line in the Bible, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. Well, you could change the word and then just say idolatry, idolatry, all is idolatry. It's everywhere. It's possible to idolize anything and kind of turn it into something that, you know, is kind of a way of feeling better about yourself. Now, the interesting thing about idolatry, is, you know, in regards to Apple or any kind of idolatry, you know, if you're going to really be an, you know, sort of idolize something and become a real zealot, it always requires demons. Got to have demons. And so if you're an Apple idolater, you know, then it used to be that Microsoft was the demon. And then, you know, Microsoft is, since, you know, sort of the iPhone kind of took over and, you know, kind of Apple's attention and it sort of took over, Microsoft really isn't the demon anymore so much as, you know, Samsung is the big demon. And then you have Google, you know, mix in there Google, Android, and then Google. But, you know, with Samsung being the biggest demon in the, you know, that's, you know, as of right now, with the Apple, you know, the Apple sort of idolization. And, you know, you want to, like in the realm of motorcycles, and I've talked about this in a recent past, you know, the Harley Davidson is the one that's the motorcycle that's idolized. And it has been for quite some time, and it's sort of lost some of the idolization. But even so, you know, the people that really idolize it, they have, you know, they have demons, and the demons in the Harley Davidson idolization, or the Harley, you know, sort of the Harley Davidson false religion, the demons are Japanese motorcycle companies. So primarily, it's been Honda and Yamaha are the Harley Davidson religion demons. And, you know, and so and, you know, if you're a religious zealot and you've actually turned your religion into idolatry, then you can have various demons. And so that, you know, one of the demons, the, you know, would be, you know, there could be any number of demons, but one of them could be atheisms, for, you know, the atheistic zealots, for example, those could be the demons. But let's say you're an atheistic zealot, and atheism is sort of your idolizing atheism. Then the demon is any kind of religion. Then the demon, you know, then you have, you know, sort of, you know, the Bible-thumping Baptist-type demons. And so those people are sort of, both of them are engaged in idolatry. Both types of people are equally engaged in idolatry, even though one of them thinks they've got the Bible and they've got the words about the truth and so on and so forth. They're engaging in idolatry, and they're regardless of what, you know, the things that they sort of surround themselves with aren't doing them any good. You know, you can have the words about the truth and carry your Bible around on your hip and do all of those things, and it's all for naught. You're wasting your time. You might as well, you know, you might as well go to the bar and drink or something and enjoy yourself. If you know, although that doesn't work either. You know, but they might as, yeah, I'm just trying to make the point that they might as well just do whatever, because, you know, you engage in your idolatry, and it's not really going to get you anywhere. You know, maybe you can kind of engage, you know, to a certain extent, people engage in idolatry. And perhaps, you know, some people that can satisfy them if they find other people, other sort of idolizing fans that are able to, you know, they kind of commiserate together, you know, and then they can get together as a group and try to find some sort of meaning in that. And of course, there is no meaning in that. Now, in the case of Apple, you know, that, you know, or Harley Davidson, either one, you know, they'll take all, you know, they'll take your money, you know, and they'll try to give you some kind of an experience from it, but they're more than happy to take your money, you know. So, but so what you're, you know, this story was really about, and now I realize it was about. You know, these people are idolizing, you know, so it's, you know, you can call them zealots, you know, atheistic zealot, religious zealot. It's idol worship. You know, it really is about idols. And with this in mind, you know, then you go back and you read the Bible stories. Excuse me. You read the Bible stories, you know, that's talking about the ancient Israelites kind of turning away from their creator and, you know, kind of making false idols and so on and so forth. This is what it was. You know, it wasn't just, you know, making, you know, some sort of a shrine in the corner of your living room. This, you know, making false idols happens in your mind. That's where the real problem happens. It happens within your mind. And people make these, we have these false shrines in our mind, and people do it constantly, and then they, you know, and then they become obsessed with those false shrines in their mind. But idolization is everywhere. It's and, you know, of course, we're all fallen creatures. We come into this world sort of fallen, you know, born in sin, subject to a kind of an imperfect world, and we're imperfect ourselves. And so there's all kinds of things that we can, kind of false idols that we can fall, you know, different people will fall into. Just, it's everywhere. You know, it can be in terms of commercialism. You know, you find the product, you know, in the case of Apple or Harley Davidson or whatever, that you sort of, or Sony back in the 60s and the 70s, that you sort of fall into and give them your money. Or it can be a church, or it can be, you know, your atheist group.
And then there was another one about this kid that talked about using a gun to take care of business and shoot his neighbor's dinosaur. Now, that may sound silly. They come in and get the kid. But you know, with all these cases we have seen over and over and over and over and over, shall I say over a couple more times, in this country of school shootings, and parents and people say, why can't we spot these kids? Why can't we spot this if the parents aren't able to do it? Why can't we at least try to? How can we see the signs? And they've begun to do studies and things, and they find that there are signs. And the signs, quite often, are children who fantasize about using guns. Gee, go figure. That the fact that they might actually use them, that they might fantasize, write letters, and otherwise put it out there in a way that they can deny. Oh, I was just joking. Oh, that was just a story. And so now, in school, they've gone the other direction. They've become extra, extra sensitive to anybody who seems to think that using guns to solve problems is a great idea, even in a story. And, yeah, you could say that's going overboard, but we've already gone overboard in the other direction. So, you know, that's the opposite side of the story. I'm sure if you were a parent whose child had been killed or maimed by some kid who went nuts, and you heard that this had happened, you'd say, good, maybe they got a little SOB before he managed to hurt somebody. You know, and that's what they probably think. Now, in your contention that you find story after story after story of proof that if you go to public schools, they're your kid, you're getting exactly what you deserve, you know. By the way, oftentimes you say this with almost a pride, you know, like resentment, you're getting what you deserve out there. There's a term for that. It's called Schadenfreude. I think I probably talked about it before. It's getting pleasure out of somebody else's misfortune because they deserve it. And I hear a lot of Schadenfreude when you read these stories. But I got to point out a little scientific principle, logical principle, known as cherry picking. Cherry picking is when you go looking for something and by golly you find it. And then you just convince yourself that this is the truth. There are people who believe things come in threes. They really believe this. And they go looking for them, and gosh, they just find tons of instances where things come in threes. Now, mind you, if they believe just as solidly that things came in twos or fours, I guarantee you they'd find just as much. But that's the power of cherry picking. You go looking for what you want and disregard the rest. So, you know, I thought I would uncherry pick the whole idea here, and I know you're Googling for certain types of stories, so I Googled really quickly, just once here, for private school abuse. Here's some of the headlines. Abuse in Britain's boarding schools, why I decided to comfort my son, I'm just reading the results here, I'm not going to the sites. Private school sexual abuse lawyers. Attorney Kelly Clark, attorney. Sexual abuse of children in private schools often involves religious institutions and other charitable organizations. Elite Horace Mann prep school students tell of decades of sexual abuse. Wave of sexual abuse allegations in private boys' school in Britain. School sexual abuse survivors end decades in secrecy. Horace Mann, I guess that's the one where this happened to. It's on Wikipedia talking about this. 20 British private schools face ruinous child sex abuse claims. And, of course, we all know that churches also are being ruined. Churches, religious institutions being ruined due to abuse of kids. And that's people who believe in God, supposedly. At Brooklyn School alleged, years of abuse at Brooklyn School alleged, 130 private schools in child sexual abuse scandal. Independent schools, 130 independent schools have been implicated in sex crimes against hundreds of kids. Anyway, that's just the top results. So I reverse cherry picked. I think if I typed in there something else, it would find whatever I wanted, pretty much. Like I said, if you go looking for stuff in this world, you will darn well find it. And if you're going to make a rule and say, well, you know, this school is better than that school, then you need to show all the facts, plus and minus, back and forth if you can. Otherwise, it's just cherry picking. And that's what most people do, you know. You find this in politics, they'll tell just the bad things about a candidate in order to get them and slander them and not the good. The candidate going for office will talk about just the good things that he's about, but he's not going to mention the bad. It's never a complete picture in almost all cases. And to get the real, true story on something, you have to look at all sides. Yeah, left, right, up, down, back and forth. That's the point I'm trying to make. It isn't fair to just cherry pick and then say, well, I got proof. I got lots of this evidence. Yep, sure you do. And it's probably all true. But is it really all there is? Catch you later. All right, Tom, couple of comments I'm going to make here. And I might as well put them into one comment here. First of all, something that I think I noticed a while ago, but in the last few podcasts, I'm really noticing it. These are language things, and you've been talking about language on these podcasts, but you got really into this language analysis, and this one guy that does it, and he can determine things about people by the words they use and things like that. And I really found that fascinating because I've always kind of been into language, and I realized that part of the reason that that is the case is also it tells a little bit about me, and I won't go into that, but, you know, in any case, I've always had this interest in parts of the language. I like to kind of, I seem to take notice of how people talk and words they use and funny little things like that. Just something I've always done in a way that probably a lot of people don't. I don't know. But in any case, for what it's worth, at one time, I noticed that what you would do is say, you know, tons. I mean, you had quite a count of, you know. Now, I don't know if you became self-aware of that and trimmed it down, but it doesn't seem like you do that as much.
Okay, well, let me interrupt. I'm very well aware that I have this really bad habit of saying, you know, and there was a period of time, now it's been a number of years ago, I really was trying from one podcast to the next to catch myself, and if I said it, then I would point it out. That's been probably, that dates back probably to maybe 2006, 2007 maybe. Maybe 2005, I don't know. But I was very much aware of it, and then I kind of stopped worrying about it. But nonetheless, that's probably another word that I use a lot. I try to be conscious of what I'm saying and sort of get rid of the, at least of the you know, because that's really sort of a crutch. It's sort of a sound that you make while you're trying to think of something else to say. Or I think in especially think of something else to say in regards that the person that you're talking to, you're trying to get the feeling across, or you're trying to get a thought across, or you're trying to get a state of mind across, or a state of reasoning across, where the other person that you're talking to can kind of be on the same page. And so I think that's where that word kind of really comes in. So I've tried to become conscious of it, and really I would like to completely eliminate it from my vocabulary. That would be a great project, is to completely get rid of that, because it's a habit, and it's actually very annoying. When I listen to things and I hear people, there are times, and it certainly applied to me in the past, where every 10 words I was saying, you know this, you know that. And I've been very much aware of it for years, but it is possible to get rid of it. So I think that's actually, I'm glad you brought that up, and that is actually really worth kind of pursuing. Now, of course, I think those kind of, there has to be a name for that, because not only you know, but yeah, some people will go, you know, sort of as a filler, like that right there. They do that perhaps to kind of keep their side of the conversation going, or they're trying to talk too fast. So what I find is if I am trying to eliminate those words, then, and I'm making a conscious effort, then I tend to talk slower. But it's my podcast, and so I can talk as slowly as I want to, and if there's some dead space, it's not radio, so it doesn't matter. So, but I'm glad you brought that up. So I think that I should begin to make a conscious effort to get rid of that, to eliminate that from my vocabulary. And I think I really do believe that it's possible to do that.
But maybe you're not aware that you've come up with some new words, or a new set of words that you use a lot, and that it's a phrase you say a lot, which is and so on and so forth. And another one is and what have you. But the so on and so forth one is huge. I don't know if you even care, but I thought I'd just kind of throw it out there as kind of something to be self-aware of when you hear yourself saying it and say, all right, am I going to say it again? Because I dare say in one podcast, you were saying this just rapidly. You know, one time after another, after another, after another. And I don't know if you're self-aware of that. But anyway, I will not point that out again. Just point of interest, in case you're interested. If not, then forget I ever mentioned it. No offense intended. Okay, the other comment. You were on this podcast talking about this wonderful technology that you thought was great use. You raved over what a great use of technology it was and what it was, I guess, in some new cars, or maybe in specially set up cars, might now be the point, that they sell to people who are, if you will, deadbeats. People with terrible credit, people that you just can't trust, and they get a car, probably they're specially set up, that not only relays where they're located, but allows the finance company to shut her down. And you said, what a great use of technology. Now, you didn't read the rest of that article, but I'm assuming it was going someplace. Something about having to take care of her children. What do we do with the children? So, yeah, that's one of those funny things people will say, because people bring up children to try and get their little emotional hooks in you to whatever cause they're trying to get you on to. What do we think about the children? Think about the children. What about the children? Anyway, in this one, the curve was that this lady needed to do something for her child. You know, the child was sick or the child was this. And I was off half expecting it would be a story about some woman whose child was having an attack of some sort. And so she was going off. She needed to go off to the emergency room. And the car wouldn't start. And the child died or something like that, and then she sues the people that put this on there. Was that the end of that article? Because I don't think you ever ended it. You just kind of flew off from that edge. Maybe that's not how it ended, but I half expected that would be the case. And in this litigious world where lawyers like to take on anybody...
Okay, let me interrupt again. Yeah, as I recall, the article that I was talking about... they were making the point that the woman was, her child was having some kind of asthma attack or something, and she was trying to take the child to the emergency room. That's kind of what I recall off the top of my head. But nothing happened. The child didn't die, or, you know, they were just using that as an you know, sort of, like you're saying, sort of as an emotional hook to... try to make it seem like this was an evil use of technology. The woman was a deadbeat. If you borrow money, and I don't care whether you have kids or whatever it is, if you borrow money and you don't pay it back, you're a deadbeat. And you can write all kinds of articles and say that, well, if I make the payment, I won't be able to feed my kids, and it's taking the, if I make the payment to this evil rich person that I borrowed the money from, that they're taking the food out of the mouths of my children, and so on and so forth. And that's sort of the gist of this article, how evil the technology was, because this poor woman, this poor deadbeat woman that wouldn't pay her car payment couldn't take her child to the emergency room because they turned the car off. Because she, after 3 days, of non-payment of the car payment, she wasn't able to drive it anymore. And, you know, regardless of that, let's say that they didn't have this technology, or let's say this technology was banned, and so then therefore if I was in the business of selling cars and making car loans, and it's obviously one of these buy here, pay here type places, I wouldn't, obviously she has a history of deadbeat credit, or it wouldn't be on there to start with. The device, it was a used car. They're not doing that with new cars. This is used cars, by the way. Chances are I wouldn't loan her the money. So if she's going to be, she's a deadbeat, she doesn't, she has a history of not making payments. And so then if the child has an asthma attack, then what's she supposed to do? She's a deadbeat. She doesn't have a car. So then I guess she calls 911 or something. But I think this is a brilliant use of technology, because it forces people to do the right thing. And if people won't do the right thing on their own, and it's obvious that they won't, let's force them to. Why not? Let's force them. If we can utilize technology in creative ways, like, and this is a very creative way of using this kind of remote control technology, tracking, and the 3G, 4G networks, and remote control via smartphone. This is a brilliantly creative use of that technology. Then why not? Then you can force people to do the right thing. And that's actually a good thing, because then it forces this woman to be a good example to her asthmatic child. You borrow the money, you have to make the payments. Even if it's an inconvenience, and even if you don't want to, and even if you want to spend the money on, you know, some other thing. Maybe the woman has a gambling problem. Of course, they're never going to say that in an article like this. No, we'll never say that. Or she probably, you know, she may well sleep around or something, have, you know, a whole procession of guys coming to sleep in every night. They're never going to mention that in an article like this. They want you to feel sorry for the poor child that this woman drug into the world against its will. Feel sorry for it, because it has a deadbeat mom. So I think this is brilliant use of that technology. This is really creative, and it's really brilliant. And and a thing I really like about it, it is forcing people to do the right thing. So when they're talking about loss of privacy and what have, I think that we should have cameras everywhere. If people won't do the right thing, if they're raised to not do the right thing, naturally be able to do the right thing, then as a society, we should force them to do the right thing. And at least then they can be a good example, even if it's forced, they can be a good example to their kids.
I suspect that that's where eventually it will end someday. Just a matter of time before this device leads to the death or severe injury of somebody, and these injury lawyers will sue back to the person who is trying to get the money. It's kind of like the way that, you know, landlords, when they weren't paid in the past, they would shut off the heat and the electricity, and they wouldn't pay it for the person. They'd say, you're not paying your rent, and you're not paying, you know, I pay the heat and electricity, so you're not getting any, at the very least, you're not getting any heat and electricity. And they made that illegal. There isn't a state in the United States where a landlord can do that legally now. You have to legally evict these people, and sometimes that can take months. Meanwhile, guess who's paying for the goodies? So, yeah, great technology until the law gets in there and says, no, you may not do that because some old lady died, because the heat was shut off, some kid, you know. There are these rare cases that happen. And in the old days, it would have been just plain old too bad back in the 50s and 40s and before. You know, it would just be too damn bad, you know. But now with litigious lawyers, you know, everybody's right to protect it to the nth degree. So you were saying how this was great use of technology, you know. Make those people pay those payments or shut them off, you know. So the thing, one thing I fear that someday lawyers will indeed put an end to that. But even let's assume that you could have it your way, Tom. Let's assume that we could be God and we could make it so none of these people, if you don't pay, you don't get. Landlords can shut off your heat. Landlords can shut off your electricity. Car loaners can shut off your car. Basically, if you don't pay for it, you don't get it. Period. And if something bad happens, well, that's your fault, not ours, because you didn't pay for it. And you know, that might make some common sense, quite honestly. So when you were reveling in this, I think it was like the next podcast you were talking about this, the idea that what they're starting to do, and you said, this is where it's going to head, folks. You know, they're going to have cameras in your car and GPSs in your car, and they're going to monitor us everywhere. And this is where it's going to go to make us all behave and do the right thing. And I know you were making fun of it when you said that, because you didn't want it. You do not want these monitoring things and other such things put into your workplace.
Okay, let me interrupt again. No, at one time, and Scott and I in particular had, you know, we exchanged voice files back and forth, and at one point I was dead set against the idea of having a camera from the company, you know, kind of monitoring me in the truck. But I've since actually changed my mind. I'm willing to do it. But I think that there should be not only a camera in every truck monitoring every driver, as far as commercial goes, that should also apply to every vehicle that's on the road. And the reason that I've changed my mind primarily is, number one, my parents were in that accident a number of months ago. Now, they've recovered nicely and so on and so forth, and they've pretty much, I think, are completely over that. The doctors keep finding little things that kind of happened. But they seem to have recovered from that pretty well, that accident. But that was as a result. We don't know if the woman was texting, and we'll probably never know. But she was obviously distracted. Somehow she was distracted. So would that, if there was a camera in her car looking right at her, recording constantly, would that have prevented her from being distracted? It's hard to say, but there's a chance that there's a percentage of people that would be become aware that this thing was constantly recording them, and they would change their behavior as a result. Now there would still be people that are still going to text and do whatever right in front of it, in the same way that people will shoplift in a place that clearly has cameras. But that does stop a lot of it if you put the cameras up. So I'm serious. Let's have cameras everywhere. Let's use the technology to force people to do the right thing. That's what's so brilliant about this. This was about a used car thing in Las Vegas. You know, the buy here, pay here type of thing. With used cars, and these people were. It was made clear to them up front. This wasn't something that was, you know, kind of a surprise and sprung on them. It was made clear to them up front that these cars, you buy a car from whatever dealership, and it's going to have a monitoring device in it. And if you don't pay the payment, it gets shut off after the car gets shut off after 3 days. And that's the terms. You either like the terms or you shop elsewhere. You either sign on the dotted line and get the car and make the payment or not. And it also, by the way, it also is great that they can track the thing, because then if they have to send a tow truck after it, the repo man, if they send the repo man after the vehicle, then they know exactly where it's at. And it can't go anywhere in between. Now, I'm surprised, by the way, as an aside, I'm sort of surprised that as litigious as our society is, I'm sure that it has to have happened that a car has been repossessed, and then someone didn't have the car, and as a result, a child or somebody died because they couldn't take them to the emergency room or whatever. I'm sure that has had to have come up at some point. There has to be some sort of litigation that's taken place, as far as cars being repossessed, because you can see how the line of thinking would kind of proceed into that, where, oh, well, you, how dare you repossess the car? They couldn't take their kid to the emergency room, and then they died or whatever. So I'm surprised that it hasn't proceeded into that, the line of thinking. But on the other hand, you know, repo men are alive and well, I believe. So, but no, I have actually changed my mind. I want the technology. I embrace it. My parents getting hit, that was one thing. And then my aunt here, I don't know, I guess it's been about a month ago now. She was on my, well, that was when my parents, she was on her, on my, turning into my driveway, waiting to turn into my driveway, waiting for the oncoming traffic. And she started to make the turn after the oncoming traffic, going to visit my parents, started to make the turn into my driveway. So in the meantime, this gal, a younger gal, decides that she can't wait. There's my aunt's waiting to turn into my driveway, and there's at least there was a truck or something that was behind her, behind my aunt, and this gal just decided she didn't want to wait, and she just decided she was going to pass, and she ran right into my aunt as she was turning. And that's I don't know if the woman was distracted, very possibly she was. We don't know that, but she could have been looked up at the last minute and saw that she was about to hit the back of that truck and whipped out and decided to go around. That's very possible if that's what happened. So, again, I really think that we should put cameras everywhere. Because as a society, if we don't have any morals, if we don't have any self-control, if we can't build that into our kids, can't encourage our kids to have self-control. In fact, we go in the opposite direction, encourage them not to have any self-control. Then we have to have external controls, and those external controls, we've got the technology now. It's kind of like the bionic man. We have the technology to rebuild him and make him stronger and faster and better. Well, let's bring it on. I embrace the idea of the company putting a camera in my truck. It's just a matter of time before they do it, and it's going to be in all commercial vehicles. And so it's just a matter of time then. Let's go ahead and put it in every, because these cameras are relatively inexpensive, let's put that in every private vehicle as well. And I'm not being facetious about this. I think that this, in a society where people don't have any self-control, then this kind of monitoring forces them to have some self-control. It's not a cure-all. It's not going to force everybody to have self-control, but it, when you start monitoring people in this fashion, it does cause a lot of people to control themselves, whether they like it or not.
But Tom, it's a wonderful use of technology. Crying out loud, yeah, you know, that's just the way we use technology and stuff to make people behave, force morality. Yeah, that works. Now, I'm obviously being sarcastic here, obviously, but I think you can see my point. You know, since when did force morality ever work? You know, but I do think that we're losing a lot of our rights. You know, to get paid for what we provide, and but at the same time, you know, it is a right to drive a car, and geez, there was some way of knowing, you know, that people were, let's say, without spying on us particularly, what if telephones had to run their texting through the telephone GPS, and there was intelligent technology required for all telephones such that if you were traveling and you were texting, it would call into question, you know, the legality of what was going on and some way of getting back to you. I really think someday the technology may come along to monitor this kind of activity and various other things. And little by little, as long as it isn't actually a camera pointed at you, you might not have any problem with it, Tom. I think it's the camera that bugs you the most, as it probably would bother any of us. But would you be bothered with something short of a camera that monitored your activity, monitored whether you did drugs or not, monitored whether you got enough sleep or not, monitored whether or not you, you know, various other things? Actually, you are monitored right now in a way that some other truckers are not. I happen to know some of those other truckers who don't have to do what you have to do, that being the hours of operation. They're able to fudge their logs and make it seem like they're abiding by the laws when in fact they are not. And then you hear about these accidents like the Tracy Morgan one, where the trucker very well was probably fudging his log and he was way too sleepy. Or maybe he wasn't fudging his log and he just started working, but he was sleep deprived. So it happens. So what if there was a way of enforcing all this? Now you have it because there's a GPS looking at you, and they can tell a lot of ways if you don't tell the truth or not. So does that bother you, that you're being big brothered that way? And what if there was more and more and more of this? Short of, as I said, short of a camera, how much big brothering will you put up with? Because you're obviously putting up with some, because I can tell you this other truck driver of mine that's a friend and independent will have none of that. She maintains you can't make a profit, you can't make a living with the rules the way they are. You're obviously proving that not to be the case, but people believe what they want to believe, as you know. So just curious, you know, if you have any limits on where you would put big brothering as being too far. Where's the line that you would say they just stepped over it? Because you're getting some big brothering now in a lot of different ways. And, you know, when we go places, there are cameras all over the place. As I said, in your truck, that GPS information goes out the satellite. They know where you are and when you are. Your cell phone, the telephone there, also the towers on that, they can go back and pull logs from those towers. And they can for purposes of things such as solving crimes, they can go and find out where somebody's phone was at any point in time. The records are actually kept. And that means that they know, well, at least where your cell phone was, and probably more than likely where you were at any particular point in time. They can go backwards and find out. This is all archived. That's big brothering. Is that too much? Should we stop this? Should we make them throw all those records away and not keep them? Should we, you know, how far is too far? Is the camera the line over which is too far, or are there some other ones? You know? And you can go backwards from that, all the way back to that article that you thought was so great, where the woman is being big brothered, albeit she's a deadbeat. But, you know, it's the same thing. Do deadbeats get this? Are deadbeats the exception to big brothering? Well, they should have big brothering, but people that haven't done anything wrong shouldn't. So a lot of these teenagers who haven't done anything wrong shouldn't have any big brothering for texting, right? They haven't done anything wrong. They haven't killed anybody yet. I don't know. I'm not taking a side either way on this, Tom, but it just seemed when you made that comment, I had to chuckle because it seemed like only minutes earlier I was listening to you saying the opposite thing. And in one case, you're coming down against big brothering, and in the other case, you know, you're all for it. You know, great use of technology. All right. I'm just kind of rattling your cage a little bit. Catch you later.
Okay. Well, thank you, Scott. No, I've changed my mind on as I said, at one time I was against the idea of the company putting a camera in the truck, but I've changed my mind. I think it's a good idea, and I think it should be in every truck, even owner-operator trucks. And by the way, it's probably your friend that's the owner-operator. It's probably just a matter of time before the government decides that owner-operators are going to have to put these monitoring devices in their truck, too. That's been long been a sort of a bone of contention. But it's just a matter of time before everything's going to be electronic logs, and it's going to be tracked, and so on and so forth. And there I said that. So on and so forth. Dot, 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 I guess I could say. Into infinity. But in any case, it's just a matter of time. But if people, generally speaking, if people won't do the right thing, because, and certainly in our case today, the way generation after generation of people have been raised, it's all about me, me first, I have to be first, the hell with everybody else, I have to be first, it's all about me and how I want to be and how I want to do, and I want to be at the head of the line, and on and on. And so, therefore, we have to, if people won't do the right thing, then let's use technology and make them do the right thing. Now, I know you were talking about, you know, you can't legislate morality and what have you. You may not be able to legislate morality, but you can damn sure enforce it with technology. And that's what I think's brilliant about it. You can force people to do the right thing through the creative application of technology. You can actually force people to do the right thing. And that's what I think is so brilliant about this used car sort of tracking technology. So there have to be other applications of that. For example, now it would never be, but I'm just kind of pulling something out of the air. Let's say, for example, you didn't make your house payment. If they had electronic locks on your house, all they'd have to do is just remotely take the ability for your for you to have access to your house, for example. Now, obviously, that's something that's not going to happen, obviously, because of the way our laws are. But that would be an a potential application. And so you can begin to think of different ways. How can we force people to do the right thing? How can, for example, with the kids and the sex, I would have no problem at all putting cameras monitoring everywhere. And if you're a parent, you know, you can say, well, that's big brothering or whatever. But if I was a parent and I had a, you know, kind of depending, I wouldn't have any problem at all kind of monitoring the kids with cameras via their cell phones, if they had cell phones, etc., etc. Have no problem at all doing that. And if the kids didn't like it, too bad. I'm the parent. What I say goes. And they may not like it at the time. It's not my job as a parent to be a friend. Usually later on, typically, when people mature, they may not like what their parents did in the moment, but later on, when they mature, if they mature, then they realize that what the parent, the parent did the best they could, and they actually weren't all that bad, and they were glad, and, you know, if they're honest, then they're glad that the parent restrained them and didn't let them do whatever they wanted. So, but I think that if we don't, as a society, we've lost the ability to have self-control. If you don't have the ability to have self-control, then it will be imposed from the outside. And so let's just use technology to do it. Let's figure out really creative ways to apply technology to force people to do the right thing. I think that's a brilliant use of technology. So, anyway, and I'm not being facetious, but I really do think that we need to have cameras in all vehicles, because this texting thing, and not only the texting thing, but the distracted driving thing, is really beginning to get out of control. And that, at some point, we may have to, they've even talked about putting, mandating some sort of cell phone blockers be installed in cars. And that's another possibility. You install a cell phone blocker so that the cell phone can't work as long as the car's moving. Why not? Or they could mandate that to be built into the cell phone so that it just locks, completely locks up, and won't do anything as long as it's in motion. And that's a definite possibility that could be mandated. So if people won't do the right thing, then you're going to have to force them to do it. You're going to have some kind of externalized dictator come along and tell you what to do. If you don't have any self-control, then you're going to be enslaved to your external environment, whether you like it or not. It's just you either have self-control or you will be controlled. You either have self-control or you're a slave. Take your pick. So, anyhow, better be cutting this off. Hope everyone is having a great week so far. And I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.